Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are, well, we're thrilled you decided to spend some time with us today.
Yeah, really glad you're here with us.
Because the stack of source material sitting right in front of us is, I mean, it's incredibly intense.
It is. It's dense, it's provocative, and it really demands a careful look.
Right. So our mission today is to unpack this essay. It's titled The Architecture of Deception.
Great title, honestly.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's written by a man named Brett Lambie. Just to give you a sense of where he's coming from, Lambie graduated from the University of Northern Iowa.
With an accounting degree, right?
Yeah, exactly. Accounting degree back in 1982. And then he went on to get his law degree from Creighton University in 1985.
So he's got that dual background.
Yeah, and when you read his work, you immediately notice he's evaluating things through this this very specific lens. It's like a mix of strict financial auditing and a rigid legal framework.
Which makes for a very methodical essay. But, and I think we need to do this right now, before we go one single step further into what this essay actually says, we need to pause. We have to set a very firm ground rule for today's discussion.
Absolutely. Please consider this our crucial neutrality disclaimer.
Yes.
The document we're unpacking today is highly critical of the current administration, and specifically of Donald Trump.
Very critical.
So we want to be abundantly clear with you, the listener. We are never taking a political side in this deep dive. We are not endorsing, we're not validating, and we're certainly not advocating for the author's viewpoints.
Right. Our job here is just to be your guides through the text. We want to help you understand the specific arguments Lambie is making, you know, how he structures his case, what evidence he relies on.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically holding a magnifying glass over the text itself. We're looking at the ideas objectively without injecting our own personal politics or opinions.
Exactly. So keeping that strictly impartial framework in mind, let's look at the big picture. What is the fundamental premise of this essay?
Well, Lambie's core thesis is that the American Republic is currently operating under what he calls a manufactured fog of strategic deception.
A manufactured fog.
Yeah, and he sees this fog rolling into everything, from the ballot box all the way up to the highest levels of the justice system.
And he anchors that whole idea on a pretty famous quote, doesn't he?
He does. He uses that famous quote from former Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, who said that sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Right.
Lambie is arguing that this foundational concept of transparency, mm-hmm. you know, the idea that a healthy democracy requires the public to actually see what its leaders are doing, he says that concept is facing a fundamental systematic threat.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the essay doesn't just stick to broad philosophy. Lambie brings receipts, or, well, at least his version of them, starting with the political and financial spheres.
He comes right out of the gate with the 2020 election.
He does, but he asks you to look at it differently. He doesn't view the election denial as a single, isolated event.
No, he calls it a template.
Right, a template.
The exact phrase he uses is the big lie as a template. And that distinction is really central to understanding his broader argument. Lambie points out that the administration lost dozens of lawsuits. They failed to produce evidence that would satisfy any court of law.
But the claims of a stolen election haven't stopped.
Exactly. They haven't stopped at all. So the insight Lambie wants you to take away here isn't just about the 2020 election itself. It's his belief that this continued denial is a frontal assault on the democratic process.
He's arguing it's a deliberate playbook.
Yes, a playbook designed to erode your faith in the very mechanism of voting.
And what's interesting is how he takes that idea of a political playbook
mm-hmm.
and applies it directly to the business world. This is where that accounting background of his, that UNI degree, really comes into play.
Oh, absolutely. The financial analysis in this section is intense.
He dives into the New York court rulings regarding systemic business fraud. And he uses this incredibly vivid metaphor to describe it. He talks about property values being inflated or deflated like accordions.
Like accordions. Let's actually break down what that metaphor means in practice, because it's a really great visual for what is otherwise a pretty complex financial maneuver.
Yeah, lay it out for us.
So Lambie is referring to the practice of taking a single piece of real estate and wildly changing its reported value depending on who is asking.
Depending on the audience.
Right. So if you want a favorable loan from a bank, you pull the accordion wide open, you inflate the value of the property so you look incredibly wealthy and secure, the bank gives you the best rates.
But then tax season rolls around.
Exactly. When the tax bill comes, you squeeze that accordion totally shut. You deflate the value so the property looks nearly worthless.
Which means you pay a fraction of the taxes you actually owe.
Precisely.
So he's pointing out that this isn't just a rounding error on a spreadsheet. It's a systemic culture of shifting reality to suit whatever the immediate financial need is.
And he doesn't leave that concept isolated in the business sector.
No, he draws a direct parallel from that financial malleability straight over to national security. Specifically, he focuses on the classified documents case at Mar-a-Lago.
The connection he makes there is really striking. Just as the value of a building shifted depending on the audience, Lambie notes the constantly shifting narratives surrounding those classified documents.
Like why they were at Mar-a-Lago in the first place.
Right, and why they weren't immediately returned when the government asked for them. He interprets this continually shifting defense as proof of an underlying administrative belief, a belief that the law is merely a suggestion, not a strict mandate.
Which naturally leads to a huge question about the people advising the administration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if the law is treated as a suggestion, who are the people providing the legal counsel?
Lambie spends a good portion of the essay looking at the executive branch's inner circle.
And the term he uses for them is pretty harsh. He calls them hatchet men.
Hatchet men, yes. He paints a pretty bleak picture of that inner circle. He points out that when a leader surrounds themselves with legal advisors who are disbarred or actively under indictment or, you know, widely known for peddling what have been called alternative facts, it sends a signal.
A very clear signal.
For Lambie, the message isn't that these are brilliant legal minds bravely fighting an unfair system. The message is that the primary goal of this inner circle is to actively circumvent the law rather than uphold it.
That sets up a massive pivot in the essay. Lambie spends all this time establishing a pattern of bypassing boundaries in politics and business, but then he turns his focus entirely to personal controversies.
He really shifts gears here.
He drops a highly detailed list of personal legal issues. Why does he make that shift?
Because he's trying to build a thematic bridge for the reader. He wants you to see that this culture of deception isn't just a political strategy that was drafted in some boardroom.
He argues it's deeply personal.
Fundamentally personal. By listing these specific personal controversies, he is trying to show that the disregard for boundaries is a core character trait. It's not just a tactical choice.
Let's walk through the record he provides, starting with the E. Jean Carroll civil trials from 2023 and 2024.
Those were major cases.
Right. He highlights that writer E. Jean Carroll won two massive civil lawsuits, with juries finding Donald Trump liable for sexual abuse and defamation. This was stemming from an incident in a department store dressing room back in the mid-1990s.
And the financial penalty was huge.
Staggering. The total damages awarded were around $88.3 million. But Lambie also digs into the specific legal terminology used in the ruling, which, let's be honest, can be a bit confusing for someone who's just skimming the headlines.
It is very confusing, but Lambie breaks down the legal nuance to ensure the severity of the ruling isn't dismissed on a technicality. The jury in New York found liability for sexual abuse rather than the specific legal charge of rape.
Yeah, and Lambie explains why that is.
He does. He explains that this happened because at that specific time, New York's penal law had an incredibly narrow definition of rape. It required specific elements that the jury felt they couldn't definitively check off decades later.
However, and this is key, the presiding judge later issued a clarification.
Yes, the judge stated that in everyday, common language, what the jury found to have occurred absolutely fits the standard understanding of the word rape.
So Lambie uses this to argue that you shouldn't let a narrow legal definition distract from the reality of the behavior that the jury actually confirmed.
He's focused entirely on the reality of the actions. And from there, he moves over to the criminal side. He focuses on the May 2024 conviction in Manhattan.
The hush money payments.
Exactly. He details the 34 felony counts of falsifying business records.
How does he frame the mechanics of this fraud? Because again, the accounting brain is at work here.
Totally. He focuses on the paper trail. He details how a $130,000 payment was made to adult film star Stormy Daniels to keep her quiet right before an election.
But the fraud wasn't the payment itself, right?
No, non-disclosure agreements aren't inherently illegal. The fraud was how the payment was hidden. It was disguised as a series of legal reimbursements to lawyer Michael Cohen. They hid it behind fake invoices and retainer agreements.
And he makes sure to point out this wasn't an isolated incident. He brings up former Playboy model Karen McDougal, and he uses the term catch and kill.
Catch and kill.
For anyone unfamiliar with that media practice, what exactly does that entail?
So catch and kill is a tabloid industry tactic. A publisher buys the exclusive rights to a potentially damaging story. They catch it.
They pay for the rights so no one else has it.
Right. But they have absolutely no intention of ever publishing it. They buy it specifically to bury it. They kill the story so no other outlet can report on it.
Wow.
Lambie notes that this tactic was used regarding McDougal's allegations of an affair. He's arguing that this is a systematic approach to burying unfavorable realities. It's completely bypassing the transparency the public relies on to evaluate a candidate.
Which ties right into his next major piece of evidence, the infamous 2005 Access Hollywood tape featuring Billy Bush.
The hot mic recording.
Yeah, where the comment was made about being a star and being able to grab him. Lambie points out that this tape wasn't just a PR nightmare.
No, it wasn't just bad press. It actually became evidentiary material. Lambie highlights that the take was introduced during the E. Jean Carroll trial to demonstrate a historical pattern of behavior.
A documented history of boasting about non-consensual sexual advances.
Exactly.
And Lambie broadens that pattern even further by looking at the Miss Universe and Miss USA pageants. He specifically names former contestants like Miss Arizona, Tasha Dixon, and Miss Utah, Temple Tagger.
Right, they had very specific allegations.
They alleged that there were intrusions into the dressing rooms while women and teenagers were undressed. And to back up those claims, Lambie doesn't just rely on the contestants' words. He pulls a direct quote from a 2005 Howard Stern interview.
That quote is a critical piece of his argument because it acts as self-validation of the allegations. In the interview, Trump boasted about the dressing room access, saying, and this is a quote, "I'll go backstage and everyone's getting dressed and you see these incredible looking women. And so I sort of get away with things like that."
I sort of get away with things like that.
Yeah. Lambie's broader insight here isn't just about relitigating past scandals for the sake of it. He's arguing that these aren't coincidences.
They're connected.
Yes. From the 34 felonies to Hyde affairs, to the civil liability for abuse, to the dressing room intrusions, he sees them all as a single playbook of someone who believes the rules of consent, transparency, and law simply do not apply to them.
So Lambie spends a lot of time establishing this personal lack of boundaries. But then he makes a truly fascinating pivot. He essentially asks, what happens when you take that deeply personal disregard for transparency and apply it to the massive machinery of the federal government?
That is the big question.
And to answer that, he points you to a somewhat surprising place. He points to local law enforcement in Minneapolis.
This is where the essay shifts from looking backward to looking at the immediate present. What's fascinating here is how Lambie details a situation where the federal government is actively blocking local officials in Minneapolis from accessing data regarding two very specific things.
What are those things?
Deaths that occurred in ICE custody and federal shootings that happened within the city limits.
Why is the federal government getting involved in suppressing local data? What is the actual legal argument there?
The Department of Justice is invoking a doctrine known as absolute immunity for federal agents in these cases. In a standard civil rights lawsuit, if a family wants to know why their loved one died in custody, they use the discovery process to get documents and data.
Right, they file for discovery.
But when the government claims absolute immunity, it essentially shuts down that discovery process. It prevents the local government and the families from ever seeing the evidence.
So the data is just locked away.
Exactly. Lambie argues that when a government actively hides the mortality data of people in its care, it ceases to be a debate about standard policy. He calls it a terrifying expansion of federal secrecy that crosses the line into human rights suppression.
Let's just pause here for a second, because that is a massive claim. He is saying that the lack of transparency has escalated from hiding financial records to hiding the circumstances around human lives.
It's a huge escalation.
And he uses that concept of suppression to transition into what is probably the most explosive part of the entire essay, the connection to Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, Lambie spends a significant amount of time detailing the social history between Donald Trump and the convicted sex offender.
He notes they were social peers in Palm Beach and New York for over a decade.
He points to flight logs from the 1990s showing Trump flying on Epstein's private jet.
And he includes a quote from a 2002 piece in New York Magazine where Trump is quoted calling Epstein a terrific guy and noting, quote, "It is even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side."
The younger side.
Now, Lambie does acknowledge the administration's defense here, right? He's
yeah.
not ignoring it.
Right, yes. He notes that the administration points to a falling out that occurred around 2004, allegedly over a real estate deal, which effectively ended the friendship.
But Lambie's primary concern isn't really the past friendship itself, is it?
No, his concern is how the current administration is handling the legacy of Epstein's crimes right now. today.
So what does this all mean for today? He focuses heavily on something called the Epstein Files Transparency Act.
Yes.
According to the timeline in the essay, this act was signed into law in late 2025. And the entire point of the law was to deliver total transparency for the victims by requiring the Department of Justice to release the massive trove of files related to Epstein's associates.
But Lambie points out a staggering discrepancy between the promise of that law and the reality of its execution.
The numbers are pretty shocking.
They are. He notes that as of early 2026, the DOJ is sitting on over 5 million documents related to the case. And yet they have released less than 1% of the material.
Less than 1%.
And what little has been released is heavily redacted. Lambie describes missed deadlines and a deliberate strategy to sweep the investigative reports into the dustbin of history.
So he asks you, the reader, directly why the sudden hesitation. If the friendship ended in 2004, why are the names of the powerful currently being scrubbed?
His conclusion is stark. He argues that when a government refuses to peel back the curtain on a pedophilia-fueled blackmail ring that touched the world's elite, that silence is an active admission.
An admission of a cover-up.
Exactly. He suggests it is a deliberate cover-up designed to protect the powerful, specifically protecting those elite hatchet men in the inner circle that we discussed earlier.
This brings us to the final section of the essay, where Lambie tries to synthesize all of this for the listener. After taking you through this massive tour of political theory, financial fraud, personal controversies, and federal suppression, he brings it all right into your home.
He really grounds it.
He asks, why should you care about this accumulation of controversies?
He argues that at a certain point, this completely transcends politics. You know, you have to step away from the ballot box, ignore the rally rhetoric, and look at this as a basic test of character.
He wants you to evaluate the record we just unpacked, as if you were interviewing this person to be part of your own family or your own inner circle.
He calls it the kitchen table litmus test.
The kitchen table litmus test. Imagine sitting at your kitchen table, looking at a resume, and asking yourself three very specific questions.
The first question focuses on the family.
Right. He asks, would you entrust the safety and emotional well-being of a daughter to someone with a documented history of hot mic boasts about non-consensual advances or someone found liable by a jury for sexual abuse?
The second question shifts to business. He asks, could you comfortably hand over the keys to your family business to an individual convicted of 34 felony counts of falsifying records?
Or could you trust someone to be transparent about their finances when they have fought for a decade to keep their tax returns hidden from public view?
And the third question is about guardianship.
Yeah, he asks, would you feel secure sending a child on a trip overseen by someone who frequented the social circles of Jeffrey Epstein and who is currently overseeing a massive federal slowdown in releasing the truth about those very associations?
He basically boils this all down to a massive crisis of accountability. Lambie states that the ultimate deception happening right now isn't the hush money or the hidden documents or the delayed files.
No.
The true architecture of the deception is the active attempt to convince you, the public, that character simply no longer matters in leadership.
He argues the administration is trying to force you to accept a distorted reality. A reality where asking for basic transparency is dismissed as a deep state trick.
And where facing legal accountability for your actions is automatically labeled as persecution.
His concluding thought is incredibly pointed. He says that if we wouldn't trust a person with our daughters, our businesses, or our taxes, we have to ask ourselves why we would trust them with the moral and legal machinery of a superpower.
He views things like the Epstein cover-up and the election denial not as isolated incidents, but as the predictable, inevitable results of a culture that prioritizes protecting the powerful over ensuring the safety of the vulnerable.
It is a heavy, meticulously structured argument. To summarize our deep dive today, Lambie's central thesis is that a leader who cannot pass that basic kitchen table test of personal decency cannot possibly lead a nation toward a transparent or just future.
And again, as we wrap up, we want to remind you that our goal today was simply to walk you through Brent Lambie's specific assertions and evidence.
Right. We maintain our completely impartial stance on the politics involved, acting only as your guides through the architecture of his essay.
And as we close out this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to chew on.
Give it to us.
We spent all this time exploring Lambie's premise about the absolute fundamental necessity of transparency. But let's flip the lens for a moment and look at the broader system we all live in. If we as a society were to eventually pass laws that forced absolute unredacted transparency on all our leaders, meaning we released every private file, every associate record, and every financial dealing into the public domain for everyone to see, is there any modern political figure who could actually survive that microscopic level of scrutiny?
That's a great question.
Or, if we are being truly honest with ourselves, does the public actually lack the stomach for the total blinding transparency they so often demand?
That is a fascinating question to leave on. It really challenges you to think about the reality of leadership and privacy in the modern era. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope unpacking this complex document gave you some valuable insights. Keep questioning the information around you, keep looking for that sunlight, and we will see you next time.